Welcome to STEM Talk.
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 Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society.
Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Karnegas, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here.
So it's that time again for another round of Ask Me Anything. Both Ken and I have been getting a steady stream of questions over the past few months, and I must say the questions for this round are quite good.
Yes, Dawn. We have a wide range of questions that listeners have sent us. The questions today cover, as I said, all kinds of topics, from AI to aliens to Kratom and much more.
It's a wide range. But before Ken and I start answering your questions, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews. As always, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Spotify, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker Mr. 152. The review is titled Life Changing. It reads, I've learned so much from STEM Talk. I especially appreciate how nutrition science is presented as a science and not a religion. After listening to the episodes on exogenous ketone esters, your guests so piqued my interest that I am now in a human trial investigating their safety in subjects over 65 years old.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And thank you, Mr. 152, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to our listeners' questions.
STEM Talk.
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 Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Dawn Karnegas, and joining me today is Ken Ford.
Hello, Dawn. Good to be here.
So we're doing another round of Ask Me Anything, and I'm going to start off with a question for Ken. So Ken, question from a listener. Did you see the story about how Bing's AI bot told a reporter that it wanted to be alive, steal nuclear secrets, and create a deadly virus? And do you think AI systems with human-like aspirations are on the horizon?
Oh, boy. Yes, of course, I did hear about this media report, and it's a shame that these are characterized as typical human aspirations. I have no idea how accurate the report is, but if it is accurate, it's less a criticism of AI and more a criticism of Bing's development, training, and testing. The listener asks whether I think AI systems with human-like aspirations are on the horizon. First, let me tell you that Bing is based on OpenAI's ChatGPT-4, and this thing has zero aspirations, human or otherwise. It has no feelings, hopes, desires, or emotions. Bing is programmed to generate human-like text on the data for which it was trained, and that's it. It has no thoughts, no desires, no wishes.
So, Ken, we have another AI-related question, and the question reads, ChatGPT is all anyone talks about these days, but no one seems to be able to tell me how it works in enough detail to satisfy my curiosity, but at a level that I can comprehend. So, Ken, I guess here, if you can explain to our listener how it works, that would be fantastic.
Okay, well, I will give this a shot. The latest and most capable version of ChatGPT is version 4. ChatGPT is fundamentally based on machine learning algorithms that have been sort of especially tweaked and optimized for natural language processing tasks. ChatGPT is trained in two stages. First, the model was trained on a really incredibly large data set, consisting mostly of sources from the internet, including Wikipedia, books, and a plethora of other web pages. After the initial training, the model went through a fine-tuning process, and this process is often called reinforcement learning with human feedback. And what happens here is the model then is further trained, in the case of ChatGPT, and again, this is with human feedback, to ensure that it adheres to OpenAI's definition of harmful behavior. In other words, the second stage, the sort of final stage of fine-tuning, isn't designed to make it, quote, smarter. It's designed to make it appropriate. Once the model is trained and fine-tuned, then it's deployed on servers. And this is what one interacts with when you interact with ChatGPT. You're really interacting with large language model on a server. Now, given a question or a prompt, ChatGPT generates a response through an incredibly complex process of predicting the next token or word in a sequence. This entire process, though, happens incredibly quickly, so it gives the listener the impression of a near real-time interaction, like a conversation. To appreciate the scale of ChatGPT-4, Sam Altman, OpenAI's CEO, stated that the training costs for ChatGPT-4 exceeded $100 million. And it has been reported in various media outlets that ChatGPT-4 had approximately 1 trillion parameters. More detailed explanation of ChatGPT and the inner workings of large language models would quickly go way too deep down the computer science rabbit hole. So I hope this 100,000-foot explanation is helpful to the listener. And if not, I can point the listener to more specific and in-depth explanations.
Ken, that's a great explanation. And I also have another question here for you. I've heard that ChatGPT hallucinates. So what does this really mean? And does it hallucinate in the same way that a human might?
Oh, boy. As our listener may have noted, hallucination is a very unfortunate analogy to human psychology in that it inflates inaccurate anthropomorphic intuitions. Whatever ChatGPT is doing, it's not like human hallucination. In the context of ChatGPT and other similar systems, hallucination is when it provides a response which often seems quite confident but is quite wrong and is not justified by its training data. And this is why they call it a hallucination, because when you look at the training data, this response should not have happened. There are many possible causes for these so-called hallucinations, but primary among them are these. First, it's really important to appreciate that these large language models don't actually understand the text. They rather generate responses to text based on statistical patterns in the data with which it was trained. This process itself can lead to serious errors. Also, the training data can be insufficient in various ways. Also, the statistical models that are used can cause errors. Statistics is an approximation. It's moving you towards something, and it can be wrong. And finally, complex queries from the human users and confusing prompts can also be problematic for the current generation of large language models. And it's not clear that all of these sort of deficiencies will be resolved. That said, there are substantial research programs on way now aimed at mitigating this unfortunate feature of large language models. For example, one such research project is kind of interesting that it essentially delays a response from the large language model while a second large language model fact checks the response from the first large language model. And that's kind of interesting. It doesn't solve the problem, but it's like having one human fact checking another.
So, Ken, we're going to switch away from ChatGPT. So the next question for you is, and I'm going to quote this question.
I'm glad to switch away.
Yeah. The Don Lehman interview and its emphasis on the importance of protein in preventing age-related muscle loss was eye-opening. The FDA suggests that most adults require 50 grams of protein a day. In Lehman's interview, he said his research, as well as other research, indicates that adults need between 90 to 160 grams of protein a day, especially as we get older. But several years ago, you had an interview with longevity researcher Walter Longo, which is episode 64, who had an opposite view about protein. He said the optimal diet for maximizing a healthy lifespan should be low in protein. And I bought his book after listening to the interview, and he writes that people should consume somewhere between 40 and 70 grams of protein per day. My sense from listening to the Lehman interview is that Ken and his co-host from that interview, Marcus Baumann, favor a higher protein diet, especially as you age. I was wondering if you guys could expand on this.
Sure, I'd be happy to discuss this. There are lots and lots of misconceptions about protein. The listener mentioned Walter Longo, who was quoted as saying consuming what he characterized as a high-protein diet was nearly as bad as smoking for one's health. Now, this is, of course, ridiculous and completely without legitimate scientific basis, but it gets picked up by the media. It gets headlines and press releases. Of course, knowledgeable people can disagree on topics like this, but for me, the evidence is clear that a higher protein diet is more beneficial, especially as we age, than a low protein diet. Our interviews with Don Lehman, as our listener mentioned, was episode 157, our interview with Peter Attia, episode 100, and our interview with Stu Phillips, episode 82, covered the benefit of a relatively high protein diet, especially as we age. The official recommended daily allowance or dietary allowance for a protein, otherwise known as the RDA, is 0.8 grams per kilogram. In my view, this is way, way too low. I think the sweet spot for protein intake should be about double that, somewhere perhaps around 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight, maybe 1.8. As we move into our older years, I think in some cases, particular older people doing resistance training, perhaps even 1 gram of protein per pound of ideal body weight would be even more beneficial. Now, this is a lot of protein. I, in fact, do not always achieve this level, but it's a goal. So if your ideal body weight is 150 pounds, then shoot for 150 grams of protein. Again, this is assuming you're an older person engaged in resistance training and you're trying to avoid sarcopenia. But the math is easy, right? 150 pounds, 150 grams. That's a lot of protein, my friend. Eggs are probably my favorite source, along with other animal proteins. And as Don Lehman suggested or made really clear in his interview, not all protein sources are created equal. So when you're measuring grams of protein, we're talking here about complete proteins having all the essential amino acids. Not all protein sources are complete proteins. If it's not a complete protein, then you probably need more.
So, Ken, another question for you. As longtime listeners know, the benefits that a ketogenic diet have for metabolic disorders is well established. I was intrigued by episode 153 of STEM Talk with Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, in which he shared some of the ways that ketogenic diet is being applied as a therapeutic treatment for disorders and diseases such as COPD, as well as psychiatric disorders such as schizophrenia and bipolar disease. What would you like to see as the next frontier of research into what therapeutic applications of ketogenic diet could be?
Well, we discussed many of them sort of at the surface level in some cases with Dom, and Dom is a wonderful source. And as we discussed, ketogenic diets and exogenous ketones are very exciting as therapeutic treatments for a variety of diseases and disorders, and we talked about quite a few of them. But I'm particularly interested in ketogenic diets in the context of extending health span rather than as a treatment for individual diseases. Aging is by far the dominant risk factor for most diseases. And if health span can be improved through a ketogenic diet, and for many people it certainly can, the consequences would be very beneficial indeed and would affect more than one disease more than likely. Improving one's metabolic health, whether it's through a ketogenic diet or another method, can likely delay the onset of many chronic diseases. And this is really the main issue facing most people in our society, is the long onset of chronic disease.
So, Ken, another question for you. Should people be paying more attention to their ApoB levels than LDL cholesterol? My doctor has said my LDL is a little high, but she has never mentioned anything about my ApoB levels.
Well, my LDL is a little high too, and I'm not worried about it, because by itself, it's of little diagnostic value. However, there are several advanced lipid panels available which test for far more diagnostic biomarkers. And if I were you, which of course I'm not, I would ask your physician for exactly such a panel, an advanced lipid panel. In particular, you asked about apolipoprotein B, commonly referred to as ApoB. ApoB is causally related to the development of atherosclerosis. Notice I didn't say correlated. I said causally related to the development of atherosclerosis, and it's a very useful biomarker. ApoB is the main structural component of the atherogenic lipoproteins. So each lipoprotein contains a single molecule of ApoB. Therefore, ApoB represents what is essentially a direct measure of the atherogenic particles in circulation that can enter an arterial wall and is a more accurate measure of the risk posed by these particles than the mass of cholesterol they contain. And that's estimated by the LDL value. Unfortunately, most physicians do not yet employ this biomarker. I have my levels tested via the advanced lipid panel called CardioIQ. And this is a Quest product, and there are other equivalent products. And the physician orders it. It's inexpensive, and it's covered by our insurance and most other insurances. Also, a coronary artery calcium scan can be helpful. This non-invasive CT scan calculates your risk of developing coronary artery disease by measuring the amount of calcified plaque in the coronary arteries. So this is a direct measure of the plaque. Now, there are other kinds of plaque than calcium-based plaque, but this is a better predictor of coronary events than cholesterol screening and most other risk assessments.
So Ken, another listener question. I recently came across a paper published this July in Frontiers of Neuroscience titled Overnight Olfactory Enrichment Using an Odorant Diffuser Improves Memory and Modifies the Ungulate Fasciculus in Older Adults. That was a tongue-tied title. The paper seems to say that use of a diffuser with 7 different essential oils, a different one for each day of the week, had a remarkable benefit in memory as measured by standardized tests. And this seems nearly too good to be true. Are you aware of this paper and what are your thoughts on it?
Yes. In fact, I've been tracking that paper since the day it was published, and we've had at least a handful of other listeners reach out to us about this paper and its reported results, and including many physicians. You know, people wonder, as Don said, people wonder, wow, this sounds simple, and is this even possible? And you know, what's the deal with this paper? So I'll tell you what I know about it. The research was conducted by a team from the University of California, Irvine. And it is really interesting in that it reports a simple application of olfactory enrichment at night using an essential oil diffuser resulted in significant improvements in both verbal memory and the integrity of a specific and critically important brain pathway. And that's the tongue twister Don mentioned earlier, that pathway. More research is, of course, needed, and we always say that. But it may be that the olfactory enrichment could be a low-cost approach to reducing neurological risk in older adults. And, you know, this is very simple. What they did was they identified 7 different aromas. These are essential oils, and there are 7 of them, and they're 7 days in a week. So what all they did was they had the participants cycle through a different one each day. It didn't matter the order. It didn't matter which one you had which day. They would just cycle through them, one day, one the next day. And they ran it at night for 2 hours during sleep. So there remain many questions. But this is very interesting, and we're planning to devote an entire episode to this topic in the relatively near future. It's still unclear how practical this would be, but having this happen for 2 hours during sleep, that is interesting, and we will dig in on this one.
So, Ken, that's really exciting to hear that we'll be digging into that more, too. So next listener question. The John Ioannidis interview was an eye-opener for me and many of my friends who also listened to the episode. I went back and read the article you discussed with John that he wrote in early 2020, suggesting that our COVID-19 response was perhaps a fiasco. He argued that governments and people were making decisions based on unreliable data. As the pandemic progressed, it seems as if people started relying heavily on the tracking being done by Johns Hopkins and its COVID-19 dashboard. I'm curious if you guys at StemTalk think this was a reasonable source, or better yet, can you ask Don and Ken what disease tracking sources they relied on to understand what was happening during COVID-19? And Ken, I will turn this question over to you.
Okay, Don. Well, in the United States, most or perhaps all COVID tracking sources were of dubious accuracy. And this was really due to the low quality of the information they had access to. So I'm of the belief that the team at Hopkins did the very best they could with the poor quality data that was available to them. The rules for what counted as a COVID death were controversial and remain controversial, and they were applied variably. In the United States, deaths due to COVID may have been overcounted. In May 2020, Dr. Deborah Birx, she was the coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force at the time, was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, "There's nothing from the Centers for Disease Control that I can trust." No, that's not good. She suggested that deaths are being overcounted by about 25%. In August 2020, Robert Redfield, who at that time was the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, noted that some hospitals actually have a monetary incentive to overcount coronavirus deaths based on differential compensation. Now, on the other hand, there was a study conducted at Yale that concluded coronavirus death toll in the United States was undercounted. So in short, everything associated with our societal and governmental response to COVID has been problematic and riddled with politics and self-interest. For more on COVID and societal response to COVID, I suggest STEM Talk, episode number 132, with Dr. Martin Kohldorf.
So Ken, another question about the John Ioannidis interview. They say, Ken talked about how there has been a substantial decline in trust in our institutions and the media. He said this trust over time could be reestablished through more and better transparency and accountability. What would this transparency and accountability look like to you?
What a question. I would start by being truthful with the public, rather than trying to shape their beliefs and thereby their behavior to fit some approved narrative. Also, the politicization of science does nothing to increase public trust. As for the legacy media, there seems to be little hope of reform, as it seems they view their role as telling us what they think we should believe, as opposed to conveying factual information. In fact, even the existence of facts is seen as problematic in some circles.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research organization investigating a broad range of topics aimed at understanding and extending human cognition, locomotion, health span, resilience, and performance.
So changing subjects a little bit here, Ken, this is another listener question. I love the interview with Ed Weiler. He said that we'll be able to prove the existence of other life in the universe in the next 20 to 50 years. Since you're both strong advocates for space exploration, are you as confident about this as Ed? I mean, do you really think there's other life in the universe?
Well, I like this question. And I like any Ed Weiler sorts of question.
Yeah.
So we'll dig in on this one a little. Because the question of whether other life in any form exists in the universe is interesting. But more interesting, really, is the probability of intelligent life. I'll touch on each question briefly, maybe a little more in the case of intelligent life. We discussed the search for life in our solar system with Dr. Chris McKay. He's at NASA Ames Research Center, and we did this in episode number 46 of STEM Talk. We also discussed the search for intelligent life with Dr. Pascal Lee on episode 121. He's also at NASA Ames Research Center. The search for any form of life, of course, depends on a suitable definition of life. Unfortunately, no simple definition exists. This raises the question of how we can search for something if we cannot define it. Well, we do understand what life, as we know it here on Earth, requires to exist. For example, liquid water, an energy source, and some nutrients. So if you find a planetary environment with these characteristics, and further, we find what life creates, molecular structures of comparable complexity to DNA and various proteins, we will have very likely found life. However, if it turns out that the fundamental characteristics of alien life are so entirely different than life on Earth, it will make the task of finding life so much harder. But in a nutshell, I would not be shocked if humans find life, probably very primitive life, on Mars or elsewhere, such as Titan, Enceladus, these are moons of Saturn, or on perhaps Europa, a moon of Jupiter. Now, let's turn our focus to the possibility and the probabilities of intelligent life. Much of the discussion on the probability of other intelligent life in the universe is connected to the Drake equation. Now, do not worry, this is a really simple equation, and it was developed to produce a probabilistic estimate of the number of active, communicative, extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. Now, a well-appreciated limitation of the Drake equation is that for several of the terms in the equation, these are really conjecture. You know, these are terms we don't know what value to put in the equation for that term. And there are huge uncertainties associated with some of these conjectures. And if you add the uncertainties, it starts to look very much like n equals 1. And our job as humans is to not let n become 0. So let's look at the Drake equation. It's simple. N equals the number of civilizations in the Milky Way with which communication might be possible. N is simply the multiplicative product of the following seven variables. So I'll tell you quickly what they are. You have our star, and that's the average rate of star formation in our galaxy. The average rate of star formation in our galaxy. Okay, you can get a pretty good number for that. F sub P, the fraction of those stars that have planets. Got it. Can do a pretty good job on that. N sub E, average number of planets that can potentially support life per star that has planets. A little harder, but doable. F sub 1, the fraction of planets that could support life that actually develop life at some point. So the previous one was planets that could support life. These are the ones that actually develop life. F sub I, and F sub I is a real bugger, the fraction of planets with life that actually go on to develop intelligent life. F sub C, the fraction of planets with life that develop civilizations that are capable of developing a technology for communicating. And then L is just the length of time for which advanced civilizations exist. Now you can see several of these terms are really conjecture. When one plugs sensible values into these variables, N, which is the product, seems to be a very, very small number. Probably N equals 1. Presumably it cannot equal less than 1 as long as humans exist. F sub I, as I mentioned earlier, is the most problematic term. On Earth, the development of intelligence took forever. It took a very, very, very long time. Quite likely, there are planets with life, and vastly fewer with intelligent life, and even fewer with advanced civilizations. So I don't have a clear answer on this other than, yes, I think there probably will be life, probably simple life, maybe even life we can't really identify at first, outside of Earth, planetary life. I'm highly dubious of intelligent life for the reasons I just explained. And lately, we've had a whole collection of people saying they've seen storage of advanced spacecraft in government facilities and had congressional hearings. Presumably, these would be intelligent life. So given what I've just told you, it will help you appreciate why I'm very dubious about all of this. Another thing to appreciate is these folks had to come here from distant galaxies or maybe on the other side of ours at the speed of light, presumably, and with a technology we can't fathom. And they get to Earth and they suddenly screw up and we grab their spacecraft and we have their little green guys. Very unlikely. It boggles one's mind. Another aspect about it that I find difficult is it's one thing to presume an advanced civilization with technology we don't understand. That's really easy for me to wrap my head around. But when they come to Earth, they're governed by Earth's physics, independent of technology. So they don't get their own physics. And I don't think most of our physics are wrong. So that's where I stand on that.
Awesome, Ken. So Ken, another question for you. I am sure you saw the news about technology leaders and researchers around the country issuing a warning that new, powerful, and sophisticated AI tools in development present a profound risk to society and to humanity. More than 1,000 folks in the tech industry signed an open letter also urging AI labs and companies to press pause on the development of these new AI systems. So Ken, with your AI background, do you think this is something AI labs need to do? In the absence of government regulation, do you think this is something that AI labs will do voluntarily?
Only the AI companies and labs that wish to go out of business would do that. And you mentioned government regulation. The idea of government regulating AI is much scarier than the topic they presume to understand sufficiently to regulate. I cannot think of anything more counterproductive. As one is familiar with our government, forget the idea of them effectively regulating AI. They could ruin the industry. They could set the United States back decades and make us not competitive in the world, but they will not effectively regulate it. Too often when people think about AI, their imagination is fueled by sort of a vision they have from science fiction. In recent years, these chatbots are very much in the public eye. And the algorithms employed in these applications are essentially statistical in nature. That's really all they are. So in framing a sentence about how AI has run amok, substitute the word statistics in your sentence for AI and see if you're still terrified. So consider the assertion, AI tools in development present a profound risk to society and humanity. So I took that directly from the question. Using my suggested fear reduction method, this translates to statistical tools in development present a profound risk to society and humanity. Stated this way, it no longer seems scary. In the early days of heavier-than-air flight, there were many pundits and politicians around the world clamoring that heavier-than-air flight, also ironically known as AF, artificial flight, represented a profound risk to society and to humanity as a whole, and its further development should be delayed, regulated, or banned. Now, that is not to say that AI will not be misused. Of course it will be misused. Every technology is misused. The products of AI research are leading to applications that can be used for good or ill. This is true for physics, biology, and nearly all of science and engineering. To paraphrase the Bard, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our technology, but in ourselves. Humans can invent all kinds of wondrous things, and we sometimes use our technologies for good, to elevate the human condition, and other times for ill, and sometimes just for foolish purposes. But it's up to us to choose. We live in a time when we are bombarded by fear. Much of television news now is essentially fear porn. we're told to fear nearly everything, including AI. Notice that for every identified fear, most of which is baseless or very nearly so, the solution is always to limit human freedom in some fashion.
So, another question for you, Ken. I picked up some of Ken's comments during interviews that he is not that pleased with what has happened to journalism. The implication has been that too much opinion slips into what are supposed to be fact-based stories. So I'm curious what Ken thinks about Google's tests of a product that uses AI to produce news stories. Does he think AI can do a better job of news coverage than humans? Here's a link to the story I read. Just signed me, former Homo sapiens journalist. To be clear, I'm still a human, just not a journalist.
That's a clever question.
Yeah.
on the surface, one would think AI-based news coverage would be more objective than today's sad state of affairs. And literally, numerous people have mentioned this to me, like, well, why do we even need human journalists? They're not objective. Let's just have AI do it. This is a mistake. Truth be known, our AI systems are not yet anywhere near ready for this role. My comments earlier in this episode about how they work should make that clear. An AI system which produces news stories can be every bit as biased as the humans who produce them now, but it can operate at a scale and speed unimaginable to humans. I cannot think of much more worrisome than Google, who currently censors and shapes our search results, to be also writing the news. It's a very bad idea.
So another question, and I really like this one because I loved our interview with her. Can you guys please get Barbara Thorne to Pensacola ASAP for one of IHMC's evening lectures? There have been swarms of termites all over town here. My pest control guy says there's a new species of termite that has reached Pensacola and that they are pretty nasty. Do you know anything about this new species?
Funny you should ask. I'm indeed at this very time trying to arrange a visit for Barbara. And hopefully she'll bring her husband along with her, Ed Weiler, who we mentioned earlier. And we want Barbara to give a lecture at IHMC. She is fascinating, as you've noted, and she was an excellent guest on STEM Talk episode 150. Unfortunately, I do not know anything about the new species of termite you mentioned, but I will try to find out for you, and I will check with Barbara. But stand by. If you live in Pensacola, I hope that Barbara will be here shortly.
Fantastic. Okay, next question. Everybody in the world seems to be talking about Kratom. So your interview with Chris McCurdy was very timely and interesting. I don't have a drug addiction issue other than pickleball, so I'm not that interested in what Kratom can do to help me with withdrawal. I am more interested in its ability to boost energy and help with pain relief for such conditions as joint pain and arthritis. But it's intimidating to figure out if it's something I should try. So I'm curious what you guys think about Kratom and your advice about how to find a good source of it.
As you can appreciate, we are not able to give medical advice, and this isn't medical advice. Kratom is reported to be quite effective with respect to pain related to arthritis and other musculoskeletal pain. As with anything of this nature, if one chooses to try Kratom, it would be wise to be cautious and start with a modest dose and ensure that it's accurately measured. The American Kratom Association, AKA, has a good manufacturing standards program, a GMP program, which is intended to provide consumers with information to help them make an informed decision regarding their selection of kratom-containing products. And this is important. This program includes requirements that the participants have to satisfy, and they have to show they've taken the necessary steps to ensure product is safe and that the labeling is complete and accurate. Participants that qualify and maintain the standards of the program are listed as AKA qualified vendors, and their products are listed on the American Kratom Association website. And we'll include the link to that website in our show notes. And again, for more information about Kratom, I refer you back to our interview with Chris McCurdy. He's at the University of Florida, and he's really, without question, I would say, the leading expert in the United States on Kratom.
Fantastic. And this is the last question, and I really like this question, Ken. I'm surprised we haven't been asked this before. We haven't asked you this question before. So as a listener of STEM Talk, one thing I've noticed as a theme in many of your interviews is the role of mentoring in the life of a young scientist or academic professional. I'm grateful that you give your guests the time and space to share how they became interested in science and how they grew into their careers, because sometimes the story of a person's journey is as compelling as the destination. Dozens of your guests have spoken at length about a teacher, a coach, parent, or professor who mentored them and whose advice and support was critical to their development and career. So I'm wondering, Ken, who are some of the people who most influenced you in your young life? What did they teach you, and how have you tried to apply those lessons?
When asked a question like this, one reflects on those who have helped make life's path smoother, straighter, or better illuminated. In my life, there have been many people who fit this description, and I hereby acknowledge them all. But primary among this group must be my wife, Nancy, and my parents. But frankly, many of my teachers, coaches, and other mentors were quite good. But tonight, I will mention just three that stood out and made indelible impressions. Mrs. Corr, teaching at the Frenchtown School, made third grade a rewarding experience. It was clear that she cared about her students, but it was equally evident that she would brook no nonsense. She was an old school teacher. At the high school level, Dr. Patricia Belden stood out for me. She taught advanced literature classes and did an excellent job in all respects. What these outstanding teachers had in common and were able to convey was passion and commitment. Arthur Kershaw is a legendary coach who served with distinction for many, many decades at East Greenwich High School. Although his teams were notably successful, it was not this that made him a great coach. He was in a class by himself as a builder of character in young men. In many ways, he was the best teacher of all, and his lessons were important, and they have lasted a lifetime. I was a wrestler, and Coach Kershaw's counsel often boomed across the gym in simple language, such as, "Don't be a knucklehead." He also told us not to be dumbbells. "Don't be a dumbbell." Or the classic, "Get off your back." Of course, he was not talking only about wrestling. Life gives us each many opportunities to be a knucklehead, or not, and many opportunities to get off our backs, or not. So though I had great mentors as a scientist and throughout my life, some of these early experiences shape a person in a way that the latter ones really can't. And some lessons last longer than others. And Coach Kershaw's lessons lasted the longest.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Ken. And that's a great way to end up this Ask Me Anything episode.
Well, thank you, Don. And I thank the listeners for all those good questions.
Absolutely.
STEM Talk.
So, Ken, it seems as if we received a lot more questions about AI this time around than we have in the past. And it also seems to me that many people aren't just curious about artificial intelligence anymore, but are afraid that AI is beginning to take over and push us humans off to the side. And I know I've heard that in conversations with folks as well. Do you think this fear is warranted?
Well, news coverage has made people so paranoid about everything, including AI. Somehow news is morphed into what some folks have called fear porn. In general, it's not rational to fear inanimate objects or to fear particular fields of scientific study, but rather the concern should be about what humans might do with those objects or technologies.
Absolutely agree, Ken. And if you enjoyed this interview as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at stemtalk.us. This is Don Cornega signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.